Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's myself, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, at History Chappie on behalf of the editorial team. And this week we are joined by a very, very special guest. It's Dr. Miranda Malins.
Oh, hi, Patrick. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Oh, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the Versus History Podcast to discuss your debut novel, I believe, The Puritan Princess. We're very, very grateful. Published by, is it Orion Books?
It's Orion Fiction, yes, that's right.
Fantastic. So this week, we've got some questions prepared for you, Miranda, all about your debut novel and your historical research and your interest in the topic. So I think to get us going, Miranda, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your background, your research and your scholarship and your introductory debut novel. Away you go.
Of course. Thank you, Patrick. So I'm a historian of the English Civil War, and I focus on Oliver Cromwell and his family and the interregnum. So the period of constitutional experiments, really, between the execution of the King, Charles I, at the end of the Civil Wars, and the restoration of his son, Charles II, in 1660. And I studied history at Cambridge University, and I left with a PhD 10 years ago. And since then, actually, I've been working as a commercial solicitor, so completely different. But I have continued my academic work on the side in writing articles and keeping up my research, keeping my hand in, really, as much as I can. And I also became a trustee of the Cromwell Association, which is an educational charity designed to promote the better understanding of 17th century history. So that's really helped me keep involved in this area of scholarship. And then it was on my first lot of maternity leave from my job that I started writing historical fiction. And I just fell in love with it, actually. And here we are today with my debut historical novel, The Puritan Princess. And so the book, The Puritan Princess, is about the Cromwell family. So that's Oliver Cromwell's family. And they fascinated me because they had this extraordinary and unique journey from rural obscurity to become effectively Britain's royal family, the only non-royal family to do so in this way without conquest or basing their claim to the crown on their lineage. And equally extraordinarily, after this brief flurry of power, they disappear back into obscurity as quickly as they came. An obscurity in which they still languish, I think, in popular history. So for a few years, they were Britain's new dynasty. It looked as if history was going to read the Tudors, the Stuarts, the Cromwells. And no one before has really looked at them in this way. And, you know, I want to restore them to their place in our national story.
Okay, then, just to get us kicked off, if you had to briefly outline or summarise the key features of your new book, The Puritan Princess, to potential readers, how would you do so, or what would you say?
Great. Well, I'd say that The Puritan Princess recreates Cromwell's court through the eyes of his youngest daughter, Frances. And we follow her as she finds her feet and searches for love and fulfilment through all the drama of her family's rise and fall and through triumph and tragedy. And this court is the court of Oliver Cromwell as Lord Protector from 1653. So that's 4 years after the execution of the king. We had a experimental Commonwealth regime, Republic regime. But after a few hits and misses, Britain ended up with almost a return to a more traditional government with a head of state, single person head of state, as a Lord Protector, and that was Oliver Cromwell. And he ruled there as Lord Protector for 5 years, followed by his son Richard briefly. And so the book, there's a particular focus in the first part of the book on how Parliament tried to persuade Cromwell to become king. As this was directly relevant to Frances, funnily enough, if her father took the crown and became king, she would instantly become the greatest prize on the international marriage market. There were even overtures, actually, from the future Charles II, the dead king's son in exile on the continent. He actually sent an emissary to suggest that he and Francis should marry each other and heal the divided nation that way. So, the novel's a story about kingship and courtship. But above all, it's about an ordinary family in an extraordinary position.
Thank you very much for that, Miranda. Okay, just a question, an aside, if you will. I've read a lot of books on Oliver Cromwell and the Civil War. They all tend to be non-fiction based. So how did you start the journey, or what causal factors were there that drove you to writing about this particular topic in terms of historical fiction?
Yeah, great question, Patrick. I guess it was an extension of why I became a historian, really, in the first place. I love this period. I love the English Civil Wars and the Interregnum because it is so inherently dramatic. And actually, as an academic, when I'm writing nonfiction, I often struggle to tone down the drama in my writing. I was often pulled up on it by my PhD supervisor, actually. So I think that sense of drama was always there for me. You know, I always used to try and write kind of, in the middle of the night, five cloaked figures approach the castle, and then that kind of thing, which is probably quite inappropriate for straight history writing. But this period is so dramatic. So I think it was always there in my writing style, that sort of tendency towards the slightly dramatic and the fictional. But really, it was deciding to write about the women in Cromwell's family that gave me the push. Because while they appear in the sources and in the histories, it's only ever at the margins. And they were a really close-knit family, and fiction gives me the freedom to put the lesser-known figures within it centre stage. I have the imaginative space to recreate their intimate relationships and to imagine their perspectives on extraordinary events that they experienced from the inside. And I like to think of it as a bit of a holiday from academic writing. It's a kind of liberation from the footnote is how I see it. I still do similar research, and actually the Puritan Princess, a lot of it's actually based on my PhD research. But then I put my notes down and try writing in free form and crafting the story. It's much more in the end about building the world for people to travel back to and lose themselves in. It's freeing and it's enormous fun, and it twins my love of history and English literature, which was always my favourite subjects at school. And it's just great to study the history, but then get a real creative kick from, you know, having to massage it to reveal a really gripping story and to find imaginative ways of sneaking history into the novel without disrupting the plot. It's addictive, actually. I love it.
And you mentioned there, Miranda, that your novel focuses on the experiences of Oliver Cromwell's youngest daughter, Frances. Many, I'm sure, will be familiar with Oliver Cromwell himself, his name, either from a positive or perhaps a negative perspective, but perhaps fewer are going to have heard of Francis. So what was Francis's life like growing up, and what sort of father was Oliver to his daughter?
Another great question. Well, Cromwell and his wife Elizabeth, they had a very close, happy marriage, and they had 9 children. Sadly for them, 3 of their sons died young, actually, one as a baby, and one as a late teenager away at school, and one in his early 20s actually fighting in the Civil War. But they almost had 2 families, actually. It's quite interesting. They had 6 children in very close succession, and then a gap of about 8 years with no more babies, and then a final pair of children, 2 girls, and Frances is the younger of the pair, so she's the youngest child of all 9. As an aside, I'm the youngest in my family, so I identified with her, which was useful. But she, like her siblings, she was born in relative obscurity in Ely. Cromwell at this point had risen from his lowest ebb, where he was nothing more than a tenant farmer. But at this point, he's still pretty unremarkable. I mean, he's the cathedral tax collector in Ely. And in a couple more years, he becomes an MP. And Frances was a child throughout the Civil Wars. So she's a child for the whole period in which Cromwell rises so startlingly to, you know, get to the centre of politics. Whereas her older siblings were adults watching this happening and actually very involved in this happening. Frances was seven or so at the end of the Civil Wars when Cromwell moved his family down to London. Around 14 when he became Lord Protector, basically king, and she effectively became a princess and moved into the royal palaces with him as a teenager. And as for what kind of father Cromwell was, he was a devoted family man and loving father. I think even his detractors would allow him that. It's very clear from the sources. He indulged his two youngest daughters, particularly Frances and Mary. He called them his little wenches, and he relished the childlike letters they used to write to him when he was away fighting on campaign in the wars. This was a very close-knit family, and you can see that in the way that they all have nicknames, and they all have nicknames for each other, and they use them, and there's a lot of, you know, banter in their letters between each other. And from Cromwell's point of view, he was always thinking and worrying about his children, even once they were adults. He was worrying whether they were behaving themselves, whether they needed money, whether they were prospering. And he took great care in arranging his children's marriages. Arranged marriages were the custom then. He worked very hard to ensure that there was affection, or at least the prospect of potential affection between a couple, and that their personalities were very well matched. And he always prioritised that over using their marriages to advance his own family, which is what many other heads of households would do. And then once he's Lord Protector, his children and their spouses are absolutely at the centre of his court. His sons-in-law have key roles in his household. And he even has his grandchildren with him sometimes in council meetings, sitting on his knee. So this is really a family business.
Okay, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you this or remind you of it, but the mere mention of Oliver Cromwell's name can arouse very strong emotions. Many will have quite entrenched and or a negative perception of the man. So to what extent does your book confirm or challenge pre-existing interpretations of Oliver Cromwell himself and or the Cromwellian period of rule?
Well, you're absolutely right, Patrick, that he is loved or loathed in equal measure. I'm very used to talking about this when I meet people and tell them what I do. But I'm going to stick my neck out and say that this book takes pride in overturning some of the most stubborn and ingrained assumptions about Cromwell. Cromwell's usually painted as a dour, killjoy, puritanical, presiding over a repressive military regime, a man who killed a king, cancelled Christmas, and got his kicks from pulling down maypoles. But this is a bit of a myth that's been peddled since the Restoration and has proved remarkably durable. I mean, all credit to it. But the reality is rather different. At the most basic level, that civil wars are often incorrectly portrayed as, you know, King versus Cromwell. But Cromwell's just one of many leaders and of minor importance for much of the war. He's not even commander in chief of Parliament's army. He had an important role in the eventual decision to try and execute the king, but it was by no means his doing alone. Nor, as it often assumed, did he take power for himself straight away afterwards, or indeed ever. I mean, never actually seized power for himself. And he didn't cancel Christmas. I'm always very very keen to stress that. That was Parliament in the 1640s when Cromwell was just an army general away fighting. And in fact, we don't even know what Cromwell thought about Christmas. I mean, he doesn't express his views at any point in the sources. As for his personality, Cromwell himself was really quite moderate and tolerant. I mean, he was a pragmatist, a natural conciliator, a great reader of people, a real people person. He wasn't a Republican, but he worked very hard to reach a peace settlement with the king after the war, and he really wanted to keep the monarchy. He loved lively debate. He was very open-minded and had lots of friends across the political spectrum. He liked to be challenged and he liked to think deeply about things. He was charming. He had, and he also had an almost schoolboy sense of humour. He loved practical jokes, which is really odd. He loved drinking, smoking, dancing, hunting and hawking, horse breeding, racing. Loved tapestries and classical statues. He's passionate about music, not music in church, because he felt that distracted people from the word of God, but music elsewhere, outside church, he adored. He took piano lessons himself. His daughters had singing lessons and he employed court musicians. And his family, he and his family even look different to how they're so often portrayed. Cromwell is never portrayed in any contemporary images wearing black. He and his family were expensively and beautifully dressed. And they presided over a colourful, fashionable court. And a court that wasn't a sort of grey and masculine military dictatorship, really. It was actually had women at its heart. And it was a very colourful and vivid place where ambassadors from around the world gathered to pay homage to this new ruling dynasty and where music and the arts flourished. This is the court of Milton, of John Milton and of Marvell and of Dryden. And masks were revived, and the first English operas performed. Frances even dances in a mask on her wedding day, and we think actually Oliver himself even took a non-speaking part in a mask at his daughter Mary's wedding. I mean, that's quite something. And they were even credited with inventing the weekend, which is something I love, because they lived in Whitehall Palace during the week, and on Fridays they tended to travel out to Hampton Court for a bit of R&R. And I think we should all be grateful for that, because we all like our weekends. As the years passed, the Protectorate became more traditional and monarchical, more relaxed and less military. And Cromwell really was presiding over it as a king, basically. And finally, looking at Cromwell through the eyes of his daughter has really helped me cut through this mythology to get to the heart of him. He was at core such a devoted family man, as I've already said, and his large family, which was overwhelmingly female, he had a widowed mother, seven sisters, four daughters, numerous nieces and other dependents. They shaped his life and were central to his court. And this is a real dynasty in the making. So I think in all these ways, Cromwell's done a real disservice in the sort of cartoonish version of him that's so popular in popular history and popular culture. And funnily enough, it stands in stark contrast to his academic reputation, where actually most historians, not all, but most historians working on him today view him in broadly positive terms.
Thank you, Miranda. A lot of the information you've shared there, I'm sure, will come as a shock to a lot of our listeners, and including me. Thank you very much for that. Okay, turning the spotlight back to the central protagonist of your novel, Frances, how did she conceptualise or perceive her own position during this complex political drama? Did she, for instance, see herself primarily as a bona fide princess, or perhaps as Cromwell's loyal and obedient daughter, or perhaps as a Puritan devotee committed to her duties to God, or something else entirely, or a combination thereof? We'd love to hear.
Well, I have to hold my hands up here and say that I imagined much of Frances's views of herself and her family. I mean, this is fiction, and she's there in the sources, but so much less than you know one would like. I mean, we have some of her letters, and actually you can tell a lot of her character from those letters, and also from the various choices and decisions that she made in her life. You can tell that she was passionate and determined and loyal. She's very independent and capable. I'd love to give you examples to evidence these traits, but it would just give away far too much of what happens in the books.
So we understand.
We need to find out how she demonstrates these traits. And she's also a real flirt, which I really like. I mean, that's really clear in her letters. She's a real flirt with a great sense of humour. So I think probably for all those reasons, I fancy she was less devoutly Puritan than her father. or certainly her older sister Bridget, who really was quite a sort of traditional puritanical maid. But she still would have been a believer, as everyone was in the time. And she was certainly very close and loyal to her father and her family. From what we know, she seemed to enjoy her status at her father's court. I mean, you know, fair enough, who wouldn't? And so she probably did think of herself as a quasi-princess, sort of in de facto terms, though I think she would always have been very aware of her family's humble origins.
Okay, Miranda, you argue that the interregnum or the Stuart sabbatical is often overlooked and misunderstood. Why do you think this is, and how do you see this period?
Well, a first clue is there in the term interregnum, actually, Patrick, which literally means between reigns, i.e. a gap between the reigns of King Charles I and Charles II. So the period doesn't even get its own term, you know, its own name on its own terms. It's squashed from both sides and given an anachronistic air of inevitable failure. Yet nobody at the time thought they were into anything. For them, the future was wide open as they experimented with different constitutions and regimes after the destruction of the civil wars. It was all to play for. And by the late 1650s, it really looks as if the Cromwells are going to be Britain's next ruling dynasty and its first constitutionally bound monarchy with a proper written constitution. It's tempting to think about the counterfactual, but if Cromwell had lived just a little bit longer, civil wars might well have become our founding national myth, and like the founding fathers in America, and Cromwell revered in the model of George Washington. That's certainly what I think. Indeed, just as a little aside, that the parliamentarians and their written constitutions were inspirational to the leaders of American independence, which probably explains why the period is perhaps more popular in the US than it is here today. There's a wonderful anecdote about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, who go and visit the battle site of Worcester in 1786 on a sort of history tour. And they're amazed even then at the local people's indifference to it. There's this wonderful quote John Adams writes in his diary. He says, "Do Englishmen so soon forget the ground where liberty was fought for? Tell your neighbours and your children that this is holy ground, much holier than that on which your churches stand. All England should come in pilgrimage to this hill once a year." I mean, that just goes to show you what an American viewpoint at the time was on the importance of the civil wars and what they achieved. But here in Britain, I think we're still heavily influenced by the extraordinarily successful propaganda campaign of Charles II, and indeed of the monarchy ever since, actually. When he was restored in 1660, Charles II backdated his reign by 11 years to the moment his father was executed. And in doing this, he consigned the Commonwealth and the Cromwell years to oblivion. And for decades and decades afterwards, if Cromwell ever featured in the press, it was as a bogeyman. Even today, the royal family and the British establishment struggle with him. He barely features on the information boards and timelines, even at the palaces where he lived. He's not allowed on commemorative stamps, and he has his portrait at Sidney Sussex College is covered by, has curtains on either side of it so that they can be drawn to shield him from the view of any visiting member of the royal family. And he's just not allowed to sort of get a look in. And there's another great anecdote about this, which is where Winston Churchill wanted to name a battleship after Cromwell, and actually the king vetoed it and said he couldn't do it. And even when Cromwell does make it onto the lists of British rulers, for instance, in the new Penguin Monarchs series of biographies, slim biographies of kings and queens of England, his Cromwell's biography has a black cover where all the other ones in the series have a white cover. I mean, you know, how can he possibly overcome centuries of that kind of treatment? The stereotype of the 1066 and all that, you know, the wrong but romantic cavaliers and the right but repulsive Roundhead. It goes very, very deep. And I think it's doubly complicated because the Roundheads won, but their cause came to nothing, in a sense. And the king came back anyway. So I think people assume the civil wars and the interregnum aren't necessarily worth bothering with. But I try to see past this mountain of bias. Instead of emphasising the watershed change of the Restoration, which is treated by many in history as your kind of 1066 moment, the sort of supposedly bringing the light into the Dark Ages, I like to look at the continuities instead across the 1650s into the 60s. Because we like to break our history into neat periods to understand it. And too often the Restoration, so the 1660s, 1670s, is portrayed as vivid and fun-loving. You know, you'll all have the image in your head of the carousing Charles II and with all his mistresses and, you know, going to the theatre and Samuel Pepys hanging out in coffee shops with his fellow members of the Royal Society. It's sort of allowed to be a sort of proto-Enlightenment almost, while the 1650s that immediately precede it are often painted as superstitious and repressive and backwards. But that's not how real life works. The same people lived and worked under both regimes through much of the changes in the late 1650s into the 60s. For instance, Britain is represented abroad by the same ambassadors. They're just sent different packets of new instructions from each new succeeding regime. Samuel Pepys, we identify him so closely with the Restoration, but he actually embarks on his career as a civil servant in the 1650s under Cromwell, and indeed under the patronage of one of Cromwell's councillors, one of the members of Cromwell's Council of State. And Christopher Wren, another great Restoration figure, he was enjoying his new chair of astronomy at Gresham College in the late 1650s, to which he was appointed, actually, by the personal intervention of Cromwell. And he was meeting with the same group of scientists who would then organise themselves formally into the Royal Society in 1660. Even the first coffee houses opened in the 1650s. So I think we do far much, we do far too much of trying to emphasise the huge disruption that 1660 causes. When Cromwell's invested as Lord Protector for the second time in 1657, there's a lavish ceremony in Westminster Hall. There's a procession through London, which matched any previous coronation for pageantry. Thousands line the streets, bells ringing, bonfires blazing, free French wine flowing through the city. I mean, that's a Restoration scene, really. So that was a very long answer, but I know that you versus history, you believe very firmly in putting the debate back into history and teaching and showing students how to question accepted narratives. And in my view, there's no better subject for doing that and for learning about the historical method than this period, because they've got such a fantastically rich historiography, the 1640s and 50s, and a wonderfully deep academic tradition. But they're the poor relation of the Tudors. They always struggle to translate into popular culture. So there's your challenge.
Okay, to segue into the next question that leads on naturally from the previous one. If teachers, students or people studying this particular period want to look for the real Cromwell and new perspectives on his rule, where would you recommend they go?
Well, obviously start with reading my book. Start reading the Puritan.
Of course.
And it, you know, it's very much based on all the kind of research I've just been telling you about, and is an entertaining way into the period and a good way to pick up a lot of great facts. But seriously, a great resource for teachers and students is the Cromwell Association, of which I'm a trustee. There is this free schools membership of the association, and we organise an annual teachers and students schools conference and an essay prize, which is really great for UCAS. And also there's an archive of articles, videos, lectures on the website, all very much aimed particularly at sixth form students and also interested members of the public. There's another great website called the British Civil Wars Project, the BCW Project, which has really good timelines, explanations of all the key events and the groups. And the Cromwell Museum in Huntingdon is wonderful. It has a treasure trove of Cromwellian artifacts and also works hard to give a really balanced portrayal of Cromwell. And Cromwell's house in Ely as well is a really, really atmospheric place to go. Lastly, my friend Paul Lay, who's the editor of History Today magazine, has just published a book called Providence Lost, which is a very readable, balanced account of the Protectorate and a great place to start, especially if you want absolutely up-to-date scholarship. So I would say, you know, to your listeners, just do get stuck in. We need more people, more young people in particular, to study and to care about this extraordinary and neglected period of our history.
The final question before we wrap up is, well, this book is focused on a female protagonist, Frances Cromwell. Are there any other female actors during this period that you would like to shine the spotlight on and discuss? Because you mention in your book towards the very end that, and I quote, the upheaval of the civil wars has given women new opportunities to show strength, and Cromwell's daughters were widely admired for their staunch characters. Are there any others that you would like to shine the spotlight on?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. This is a truly marvellous time for stories about women. Again, we often think of this as a masculine period. I mean, it's lots of battles and sealed knot reenactments. But actually, women take on real agency in this period. That civil wars is rather like the First and Second World Wars. They created all sorts of new opportunities for women. Women ran their husbands' businesses while they were away fighting. They defended their homes when they were under siege. They became highly successful spies and agents for both sides. They were really popular to be used as agents for both royalists and parliamentarians. And some, like the Levellers' wives, such as Elizabeth Lilburn, published pamphlets, marched and petitioned Parliament. Some even joined the army disguised as boys. There are definite accounts of women joining the ranks, particularly of the New Model Army. The wars created great horror and heartache for women too, of course. It was terrible. But women just got on with it. And widows in particular would be petitioning Parliament, you know, for pensions, you know, for their injured or their dead husbands. And as I say, there were opportunities to show strength. There's some wonderful individuals for people to research and write about. Lady Anne Fairfax, she's the wife of Sir Thomas Fairfax, who is the Commander-in-Chief of Parliament's New Model Army. She's actually known, Cromwell calls her the Generaless, which I love that idea, the Generaless, and she follows her husband on campaign. And she reportedly was in the audience at the king's trial and called out shame, shame. She disrupted the trial because she wanted to condemn it. Then there's Lucy Hutchinson, who's a Puritan, a translator, a poet, who wrote an extraordinary book eulogising her husband's life after his death in prison. There's Lady Brilliana Harley, who defended her husband's castle from royalist forces. There's quite a few examples of wonderful women defending their family homes. But while active women commanded admiration in some, they were mistrusted by others. I mean, you can never have it all one way. Truly, the world had turned upside down, and it was feared by some that there was going to be a real battle of the sexes that would go along with this. There was a fear that if the people can rebel against their king, then won't wives rebel against their husbands? So that's something to think about. There's a lot of wonderful scholarship right now on women and gender in this period. And with my work on the Cromwell women, I'm delighted to be contributing to the movement that I think is happening across all periods and topics in history, which is to reinsert women's voices in traditional narratives. And I'm going to carry on doing this with my next book, which is a prequel to The Puritan Princess. And it tells the story of Cromwell's rise in the 1640s through the eyes of his oldest daughter, Bridget. So she's going to come to centre stage next.
You've taken the next question right out of my mouth. I was going to ask whether you were going to be writing any more books. And the good news is for us all, you clearly are. So that's fantastic. Thank you very much. Okay then, Miranda, we would love to give away a copy of your book, The Puritan Princess, by Orion Books, for free to one of our lucky listeners. In order to facilitate that, I'm going to need a question from you, a question with a factual-based answer. Preferably something that you've mentioned in the podcast. Would you like to share that question with our listeners?
I'd be delighted. So the question is, which politician of the 20th century wanted to name a battleship after Cromwell, but was prevented by the king?
A cracking question. So could you repeat that?
Of course. So the question is, which politician of the 20th century wanted to name a battleship after Cromwell, but was prevented by the king?
If you would like to enter that competition, listeners, all you need to do is follow the link from our Twitter feed or just head straight to versushistory.com, the blog. There'll be an entry form there. You can enter as many times as you like. If you've got the correct answer, you'll be in with a chance of winning. If you are the lucky winner, we'll notify you by email, request your address, and we'll send a copy of the book direct to your door. Well, that was a tour de force. On behalf of myself, the editorial team, and all the Versus History listeners, we would like to thank you for range, the depth, and the breadth of information. New information on many accounts about Oliver Cromwell and his daughter Frances, who I'm sure many before this interview would never have heard of. So we're very, very grateful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Patrick. I've had a wonderful time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.